Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference call brought to you by Praxis International and the Office on Violence Against Women. This call is intended to support safety audit projects around the country in varying stages of the process. And I'm Liz Carlson. I'm the audio conference coordinator here at Praxis in Duluth. And I'm joined on the line today by Lucy Pope, a Praxis technical assistance partner who will be facilitating our call today. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Liz. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to everyone on the call. Today we're having a conversation about a safety and accountability audit that was conducted on child custody and the domestic relations court in Henry County, Ohio. It started about a year ago, Thanksgiving, and is at the final stages as we speak today. We wanted to share with you the lessons that were learned during the audit and how the audit team is looking at changing child custody in their community. And then we'll follow up with recommendations for other communities working on these intersections of child custody and the civil legal system. We have with us today Pam Heyman-Wiener, who was the audit coordinator, and Gabby Davis, who was on the audit team. Praxis International offered consultation and leadership for this audit, and Ellen Pence is here today to start us out with some history and some background information. Ellen is the director of Praxis International and developed the safety and accountability audit process as part of her dissertation. So she was key in the consultation on this audit. Ellen, would you like to introduce us to the Ohio custody audit?
Yeah, well, I thought I'd say a little something about this audit as being one for, I think everyone on the line, you're probably all in, either doing an audit or you're thinking of doing an audit, and I think this is a Gabby and Pam will be a really good resource for you to, you know, just ask the questions, what do you really have to do an audit, you know, because your audit may or may not be on this topic, but this particular audit just encompassed so much, and I don't know how many of you have kids, but if you have kids, you kind of go in life thinking, you know, you gave birth to this child or your partner gave birth to this child and you're raising this child, and then stuff happens and all of a sudden you and your partner are no longer wanting to live together. And where this child goes and who this child lives with or these children all of a sudden becomes a matter for the state to decide, which is very, very disconcerting to people when they don't really think the state owns their children. And the state doesn't really own their children, but, you know, all of a sudden the state is right in the middle of this major decision about your life, is who are your children going to live with and why, and are you a good parent or are you not a good parent, all these kind of things. And there's no example better than this of the invisibility of the state until something happens and all of a sudden, boom, it's right in the middle of your life. And what this audit does is shows from the point of view of people who are just living their everyday lives and now a crisis happens to them and they get drawn into an institutional process called family court that all of a sudden they're really very unprepared to deal with I don't want to say intelligent way, but in a knowledgeable way. So they get drawn into a process that's very foreign to them, and yet it is on the most important thing that they'll ever deal with in their life is their ongoing relationship with their kids and how it's going to be defined. And so I think Pam and Gabby just have a lot to say about, and Lucy too, about what it was like to do all the interviews, to read all the case files, to do all the observations, to just really look at this process from the minute someone comes into the system till that decision is made. And, of course, that decision is made and then remade and remade over the years as conflicts keep going on. But the question in this audit was really, as this decision gets made, to what extent is the domestic violence that has occurred in this family, how much of it is being accounted for and how is it being accounted for? Is it invisible? Is it visible? What has it got to do with parenting decisions? What's it got to do with how people are parenting now? What's it got to do with how they'll parent in the future? So all that whole thing of family court is family court, high conflict decisions about children is kind of one thing that happens every day. But now you've got a case that's not just about high conflict. It's not just about two people who can't get along. It's about a situation where there's been ongoing violence towards one person and the children have been drawn into that somehow, and what does that have to do with the custody decisions? And so it was a very, very ambitious undertaking. And Pam, one of the people who's going to be doing talking, is an ambitious person. And so she really kind of was one, she and one of the judges there in, I call it Defiance, but I think it's called Henry County. But in Ohio, the small community, the kind of, you know, rural community that took this on, really opened up their files, their books, their, you know, just opened up to this process. And in doing so, really learned a lot about, we all learned a lot about how this process works, what the fundamental problems are that judges face, guardian ad litems face, attorneys face, parents face. It's just fraught with one little pit hole after another of trouble. And I think the audit and Defiance didn't just show in Henry County what's going on, but really across the country. The things that we found in this audit, you would find almost every place in the country. It just looks a little different structurally. So I just want to say, Pam, for you and your community to open yourselves up to the kind of investigation that you did and the intensity of it was really, really admirable, and that you kept sticking with it, like four visits, for, you know, four trips out there, and pilot going through all your files and wanting to interview one person after another after another. Now let us talk to some mothers. Now let us talk to some fathers. Now let us do this. You were just incredible in setting all that up, and I think the work that you did really shows with the final product, which really exposes the fundamental problems across the country in trying to deal with these problems. So I'm looking forward to hearing both of you talk about the nuts and bolts of what you did. But I really want to encourage people on the line to take this opportunity to ask Pam and Gabby questions about, you know, from your perspective, when you listen to what they're saying and you try to imagine doing this, really, you know, take, you know, don't worry about getting on the line and saying, okay, I want to know about this and I want to know about that, because the whole purpose of these calls is to answer your questions. I mean, Pam doesn't have that many questions anymore. She's just been through a year of people asking her questions, and now she's got about a five-year agenda for change. So, but this is a time for you to ask her questions, to ask Gabby questions. But if we're going to do this, if we start to pursue what you just did, you know, get advice from them, because they've got lots of advice to give. So that's what I have to say about this, Lucy. And I just want to say that I learned a lot by listening in on a lot of the conversations, being in on some of the debriefings, reading the final report, reading many drafts of the report,
yes,
and then the final report. So it just was a very, very eye-opening kind of audit for me. So I want to thank Lucy and Pam and Gabby and all the people who worked on that audit, Denise Eng and Loretta Frederick and all the local people there. It was fantastic what you did. And give it back to you, Lucy.
Thank you. You know, and I think, Ellen, that it got more, the group and the team got more enthusiastic even as we went along over the course of a year, rather than kind of overwhelmed. I mean, there really was something energizing about participating in the audit.
Well, it's a funny community. There's Defiance, Ohio, or Henry County, or Napoleon, that whole little area there, because the more they found wasn't right about what they started out thinking they had a really good system, and they kept finding all these problems, and the more problems they found, the more enthusiastic they
got.
So it's an odd county.
So I'm sure that they're looking forward to the next 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Ellen.
Okay.
Okay. So we want to start our talk with Pam and Gabby about the lessons they learned from this audit and what they learned about this child custody and civil court process connection. So we're lucky to have two audit team members here. Pam Heyman-Wiener serves 23 counties in rural Western Ohio. She's been an attorney with Legal Aid of Western Ohio for 19 years and is now their regional domestic violence coordinator. She also coordinates the activities of the Family Justice Center of Northwest Ohio, which serves six counties and a migrant rest center. Over the last year, the Family Justice Center hosted the Ohio Custody Audit, and Pam is the audit coordinator. Gabrielle Davis is an attorney with the Battered Women's Justice Project, where she offers training and technical assistance on domestic violence in the civil legal system. Before joining the BWJP, Gabby was on the faculty at the University of Toledo College of Law, which is about 30 or 40 miles from Henry County. There she directed and created the Domestic Violence Clinic. While in Ohio, she also chaired a local CCR team, a fatality review team, and was a consultant and researcher in domestic violence and batterer intervention. So, Pam and Gabby, I mean, your audit gathered a huge amount of very challenging information from many different agencies. The final report identifies 11 system gaps, and each with recommendations for change. So, to help us focus our call today, Pam, could you share with us the primary lesson or lessons your team learned about child custody and the civil legal system? I mean, what's the overarching aha that you all had?
Yes, this was by far the most important experience that our community went through in being able to understand the real-life experience of victims going through the system. Many of the people who are working in Henry County have been working together for anywhere from 10 to 20 years. These are people who have committed their lives to being there to help victims, and yet the insights that we came away with from the safety audit under the direction of Praxis International and the Battered Women's Justice Project was incredibly eye-opening for us, and as a result of it, we will forever change our practices, and it definitely will be a lifetime of changes as we now look for new things. And two lessons that we learned that I want to emphasize are what I call the first being invisible bridges, and the second being the runaway train or domino effect. The invisible bridges is something we did not see prior to this audit, and basically we had a very well-intentioned system that we believed was set up to increase victim access to specialized services without making victims having to jump a bunch of additional hoops. When victims were informed what options were available to them, they were generally presented as standalone options. For example, if a victim had been physically abused, threatened, raped, or stalked, she may be advised to call law enforcement and that based on the investigation, charges may be filed and the abuser would be arrested. Or if the victim was afraid of further harm, she might be advised to get a protection order and may be told that she can get a custody and child support order that is good for up to 5 years. Or if she's in need of financial help, she may be advised to apply for public assistance or child support, and she would have assistance through those processes. What she wasn't told was that if she chose to access any one of those systems for help, she may be required to receive services from multiple other agencies, and the choice that she made when she opened that additional or that initial door will affect all the options that are available to her in every other system. And this is what we call the invisible bridges, opening one door for help, leading to multiple system involvement that the victim had no knowledge or awareness of at the time that she entered that first door. So I'm going to try to create an image of what that may look like. So if a victim calls law enforcement, what she may not be aware of at the time she calls for help for her safety and her children's safety is that Children's Protective Services may be called in. And when Children's Protective Services is called in, she may not be aware that now she's going to have to enter into some voluntary plan if there isn't going to be further action involving her children. And that could include a requirement that she get a protection order to keep the abuser away or to get supervised visitation and requiring her and her children to go to counseling as well as other services. And once the protection order is applied for and they address custody issues, she's not aware that that now means that if she needs to relocate to mom's in another state, that she can't do that without a court order. And also she's not aware that her abuser could at any time file for a divorce, and that's going to override any custody order that she was granted in that protection order. If they don't agree on custody, that she may end up having to go through mediation or a custody evaluation, or a guardian ad litem may be appointed to the case, and she may have to pay for those services. and she'll have to attend a number of appointments and hearings regardless of how that would impact her work schedule and other real-life experiences. So when we're talking about that invisible bridge, we have a victim who's seeking out that initial help for her emergency crisis situation that then puts her on what I now call the runaway train that leads to all of these other systems becoming involved in her life. And so the victim ends up being processed through all of these systems that she's not adequately prepared for being involved in, that she lacks information to make informed decisions about, that she isn't prepared to make decisions to manage the risk and the safety of her and her children may be compromised. And it can lead to certain system-induced risks, such as economic instability, parenting challenges, and safety concerns. And that's the point where it moves over into our second finding, which is that runaway train or domino effect. Again, with a well-intentioned system, that's, however, not set up with built-in checkpoints to provide victims with critical information to make informed choices about next steps and to evaluate safety and consequences to a victim's real-life experience, the system momentum will take control of that victim's life, and the victim doesn't have any way of stopping the train before it has devastating impact on the safety, the emotional, and financial well-being of the victim and the children. So I want to go that next step in saying, when we talked about the invisible bridges and how these multiple systems become involved in the victim's lives, how that actually plays out in the real-world experience for that victim and the children. So I previously mentioned that the victim calls law enforcement. So now she's got the protection order and supervised visitation. So now she's having to bring the children to supervised visitation twice a week. She's having to go to counseling appointments three times a week. She's having to go to court on the criminal case as well as the Children's Protective Services interventions. And as a result of all of those appointments and hearings, she loses her job. Well, when she loses her job, she can't pay her rent. And that leads to an eviction hearing, and then she becomes homeless with nowhere to go. And once the criminal case is done, the advocate's no longer involved in that process, and she doesn't know what to do. So then the abuser files divorce action and asks for emergency custody because the mom is homeless. She doesn't have any financial resources, and she's unstable, and the victim can't afford an attorney, and legal services is unable to help her. So then the victim doesn't have access to a car, there's no public transportation, she's not able to seek employment. So then the court grants the emergency custody order, which supersedes the order she got in the protection order case. So then once the guardian ad litem is brought into the case, the guardian ad litem recommends a custody evaluation because the abuser is saying that mom's crazy, she's depressed, she's prone to angry outbursts, she's unstable. And it's at that point when the victim's talking to guardian ad litem and to the custody evaluator that she's revealing a significant history of abuse, which then becomes interpreted as mom making a desperate attempt to get her children back. And so then the reports may reinforce the fact that mom appears unstable, she's homeless, she's without employment, she's got mental health issues, she's got angry outbursts. And consequently, it puts custody of her children in jeopardy and leads to mediation and then mom agreeing to a shared parenting because she's afraid of losing custody if it goes to court. So that's kind of the runaway train effect when there isn't places set up in the system to stop that train, to give victims the opportunity to understand what the process means and helps people in the system share information about the domestic violence involved in that family's life, how it impacts the ability to parent, how it impacts the safety of the family, and reassess what the best route is going to be. And so what that did for us is help us recognize that we really have to build in systems where there's better information sharing, where there's opportunities for victims to be well informed about the process before they get involved with it and the consequences that will occur if they choose to go through those doors, and ways to prepare the whole system to understand the victim's real life experience. And I'm going to turn it over to Gabby. We'll talk about some of the solutions that we looked at after Gabby.
Well, you know, Pam, this is Lucy, if I can interrupt. Do you think that the practitioners that you interviewed, certainly the team was not kind of aware of this, were any of the practitioners aware of what was happening in her life? I mean, did they have any tools? Did you find anyone on top of this?
I think that what we found in general is that two things, that people understood the role of each agency. What they weren't necessarily seeing is that domino effect, that by entering one door, it limited the choices that were available in the other doors, or that they were automatic effects. So I think there were people who were well informed of the system of what the processes were and what the options were for victims, but didn't necessarily understand how it would take over the victim's life. And I think that was a big awareness. But I think for the most part, because there isn't any standardized, or we didn't have any standardized screening forms for domestic violence, we didn't have any standardized protocols for information sharing in the civil legal system, that there wasn't any consistency among interveners to have a consistent response to victims. And so you had some who were not informed at all to a few who were more well-informed. But I think this whole idea of the system taking over the victim's life and the victim's real-life experience not being heard was insightful for all of us.
Thank you. Gabby, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's quite all right. You know, just building on something that Pam said, I think it's one of the things that we learned is that while the victim is processed the way she is across systems without necessarily expecting to be, other people in the system, the practitioners in particular, are not. They stay within their own confined boundaries, and that creates significant problems and frustration. So that's where we saw, for instance, that information resides in one location, even though the victim is moving around, and it stays there. It's not shared, and sometimes it can't be shared due to confidentiality reasons, but sometimes it's critical information that can be shared that isn't passed across these boundaries. We also saw lots of competing demands on family members, not only victims, but on batterers and kids as well, and sometimes orders that were either inconsistent or actually conflicting. And so
can you give us an example of what that might be?
Let's see. There might be an order of protection in place that says to the perpetrator that he must stay away from the victim and the children. There might also simultaneously be an order from the court ordering the parties to attend a parenting class. And often those parents are ordered into the same class. So in one instance, they're ordered to stay away, or at least the batterer is ordered to stay away from the victim, and in another instance, he's ordered to actually attend the same program that she attends. So we saw several examples of that sort of thing.
Another example would be where the victim is going both through the criminal justice and the civil legal system. And in the criminal justice system, there may be a temporary protection order in place, and there may have been a hearing where the victim may have said that she did not want the protection order in place, but the judge, based on the testimony, determined that she was being coerced into that decision. And then they go over to the civil legal and file for a civil protection order that allows a lot more communication between the parties. And the criminal court and the civil court didn't have any communication, And even though under Ohio law that civil protection order supersedes that temporary protection order, that the judge and the one in the criminal side had access to information that was not made available to the judge on the civil side, which could have increased the safety to safety and risk to the victim and the family.
So you have one court saying separation because of the violence, and then you have another program talking about co-parenting for the child.
Yes, and we also see that with Children's Protective Services and the Domestic Relations Court, because you'll have Protective Services saying to the victim, if you allow the abuser to have any access, we're going to take your kids. And then you have the civil legal system putting on orders for visitation. Again, lack of communication between the two systems that put victims in a situation where they're not going to be compliant with the orders, and then that's going to have serious consequences for their credibility in the system.
Thank you.
And something I wanted to follow up with what Gabby was saying, too, when she was talking about how interveners are in their own roles within their own agencies and don't see the real-life experience and the dangers that these systems are creating for the victims. It's also what leads a lot of the interveners to draw incorrect conclusions about the victim's motives, whether it be that she's uncooperative or she's not protecting her kids or that she obviously isn't too afraid of the abuser because she's returning, or whatever the conclusions that may be drawn, which are inaccurate based on the limited piece of information that they have access to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was thinking as you were talking, too, about women telling other women, so they might not formally be told that if they step into this door, there's a kind of this ripple effect. But women telling other women, if you do that, if you sign up for such a service, then all these other things will happen to you. So victims staying away from those services.
Exactly. And we saw that during the audit. And I think one of the lessons learned from that is how important it is to have effective informational materials and a lot of modems, whether it be, you know, electronically in writing, on video, audio tapes, for victims to get accurate information in a variety of forums, because that's something that we saw what we didn't have available. And so you're getting conflicting information not only from your friends and other people in the community, but also from professionals.
Yeah.
And it's not only access to information, and that's very important, but when we spoke to victims who had been through the system, they often couldn't explain to us how things happened or how they got to this point. It wasn't clear to them whether judges were issuing orders, whether orders had were the result of some sort of a mediation or negotiation, and they couldn't actually describe what they had been through because it made no sense to them, because they were, again, processed in ways they didn't expect to be. So there weren't points at which they could stop, decide whether or not the next step was a good step, a safe step for them or for their children, and understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding structurally what's happening is another important thing.
Exactly. So were there other points you wanted to make, Pam or Gabby, or should we open it for questions?
Well, I think another really important point was the lack of information that is available to the decision maker when there's these alternative routes to custody. So when you have interveners like custody evaluators or guardian ad litem, and you move through alternative dispute resolution processes, if the parties enter into to agreement on the issues, including custody and parenting time, there's often a lack of information for the judge to make a really informed decision about whether or not that was in the best interest of the family and safe for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that the judge actually brought up as a reason for wanting to do the safety audit, that so oftentimes victims would drop their protection orders or they'd return to their abusers, or she would get these consent entries that she had absolutely no grounding for what the history was, and now she's seeing them a year or two down the road and learning that there was this substantial history of violence that she wasn't aware of. And so how do we get that information at the beginning of the case so the judge is aware and then has the information that she needs to make informed decisions?
And do you think as women or victims went through all of these different systems, and when you talk about child custody, there's just a whole array of agencies that are involved here, do you think that victims were talking about their domestic violence experience or their child abuse in their families? I mean, were victims saying things to agencies and agencies weren't hearing, or do you think that the victims were maybe not saying anything, or was it all about screening? Did the agencies know?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we found from the audit was the lack of screening at various decision-making points in the system. So, for example, if a victim entered in through the public assistance door and didn't disclose the violence, and they may have been asked about the violence, but if they didn't disclose, then it gets sent over to Child Support Enforcement Agency, and there is no screening. And so if it's not disclosed or the information isn't carried over from Job and Family Services, they could be at that child support hearing with their abuser, and they could be asked whether or not they're in agreement on custody, and they're not going to disclose at that point because of safety issues. And then that, if they are or aren't in agreement, it's going to move itself over to juvenile court. And again, it's just this train that, you know, keeps moving forward. But there wasn't any formal screening processes at each step to be able to ask the questions in a way that victims would feel safe disclosing. And that's one of the primary pieces that we're working on right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, too, that the survivors that we spoke to, many of them at least, indicated that they were reluctant to disclose. They might have been advised by their attorneys not to disclose. They had no faith that if they did disclose, the system would respond in a way that was meaningful to them. And so I think that another thing that the audit taught us is that we have to be responsible as a system to disclosures and not create disincentives to disclose.
Because what happens when, you know, when I was talking about the train and the woman reaches the point where she's her children are now with the offender, what happens a lot of times is the victims disclose at that point in time. They haven't felt safe to disclose all the way along. It could be due to threats by their abuser. It could be the reasons that Gabby brought up, a number of reasons they may not have disclosed. Now they're feeling incredibly desperate for their protection and the protection of their children, and they're disclosing, and it's coming out of the middle of nowhere. And so then it raises questions of the credibility of what victims are saying. And which wouldn't have happened had there been the proper screenings and opportunities throughout the process, especially at the beginning. It still could happen. I mean, victims could still feel not safe to disclose, but it would happen in less cases.
And do you think that was the same in terms of disclosing domestic violence or disclosing child abuse?
Well, I think it gets even more complicated when you bring in the child abuse, too. I mean, I think it's complicated both ways. But with mandatory reporters in the system, which is important, but it also, I think, makes victims of domestic violence afraid to disclose child abuse for fear of losing their children and having the children placed in foster care.
Complicated. Complicated. Thank you. I mean, this obviously was a huge amount of information, and I'm so glad that you were able to kind of see this forest amidst all the trees that you were looking at. I think that those are very important lessons for us. But let's stop for a minute for questions. And
while we're waiting for questions, I wondered if I could just ask for a little piece of information from your presentation, Pam and Gabby. But Pam, you had referenced kind of the invisible bridge to all of the various systems in which, you know, women's lives are affected. And I wondered if you could kind of give me the range of what those systems are. You referenced some of them, but what are all those different systems that come into play when a woman is kind of, you know, reporting and seeking help?
The main ones that we're seeing, and quite frankly, it can be any systems. It could be the faith-based systems. It could be the school systems. But where we were looking at it in terms of the custody audit, what was, I guess, insightful for us is, for example, if somebody leaves an abuser and applies for public assistance in order to be able to have the economic means to leave her abuser, that then could prompt Children's Protective Services to become involved. It will prompt the case going over to Child Support Enforcement Agency if there's not a waiver. And in our system, they weren't screened at that point, and so then there would be a determination if there had been an agreement on custody, and it would move into the juvenile court. And that was just when the victim's trying to get economic assistance. Or a victim may apply for child support enforcement or child support, and again, once they walk through that door to get child support to be able to be independent of their abuser, it automatically leads into a custody determination. If the victim calls law enforcement, it can process it that way through if Children's Protective Services becomes involved. I think one of the ones that is very concerning for me is how often victims are encouraged to obtain protection orders, which protection orders are a very important tool for many victims, but they can also increase risk to a number of victims. And what we see in our rural communities is when a victim applies for a protection order, especially if the court does address the custody issue, that generally within weeks there's a divorce action filed. And this can have devastating consequences for victims who aren't in a position to get a divorce, whether it be because they need the health insurance or because it's going to open up custody issues to litigation. And some victims, as a result of their victimization, have a lot of other issues going on, such as substance abuse issues, if that was a mode of coping, or they may be dealing with post-traumatic stress, or they may have economic concerns, lack of support systems, a number of situations which it would not be a good time to enter into a divorce in custody arena. When they come through an advocacy agency, if they're mandatory reporters, that could be a place where then again protective services may intervene. And so that would be the kind of the outside agency pieces where of doors that we saw, or through the juvenile court when offenders apply for custody through the juvenile court. But then within the system, you've got the evaluators, such as the guardian ad litems and the custody assessors and the custody evaluators, that then also will have a huge impact on how victims are perceived in the system.
Thank you. Thanks, Pam. That's a really good indication of the complicated systems and kind of the web of networks that come into play, you know, at any point that a woman reaches out. So thank you. That's helpful.
And mediators and parenting classes.
Oh, absolutely.
EIPs, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have created wonderful systems response to domestic violence. There's certainly a lot more agencies than there were 30 years ago. But
that's right. And another thing that's unique to Henry County is that, as Pam said at the very beginning, many of the practitioners have been practicing in this small community together for 10 or 20 years. So they work extremely well together. So this is a system that is very functional.
Mm-hmm.
And within a functional system, we've identified a lot of difficulty. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think Napoleon is, what, 14,000, and Henry County is about 29,000 people. So it is a rural area, and the practitioners certainly know each other and work well together. That was one of the real strengths that we talked about, too, was some of that enthusiasm and really wanting to know and uncover some of these issues. So you're right, Gabby, of what happened there.
And I think that's one of the things that when we're looking at what we're going to review and change is a lot of practice that we put in place that we thought were best practices, in fact, when they cross agency lines, end up being very detrimental to certain victims. And that this cookie-cutter approach to one-size-fits-all, we really need to step back on and say, who is it working for and who is it not? Because I think all of the systems in and of themselves are very effective. It's the combined inertia that happens when one door is opened and how that particular choice impacts the options available in the agencies that then are triggered to become involved, that becomes detrimental to certain victims. And we always saw each agency as isolated. We didn't see that interconnectedness in how it changed, how the experience changed for the victim based on their real life situation and the doors that they opened.
Well, and that her life is complex.
Yes.
And her relationship with the batterer is complex.
Yep. And what it does is it further empowers the batterer. I mean, ultimately, in circumstances like in the scenario that I described, the ultimate outcome is really for the victim to go back to her abuser. And he basically gets everything he ever threatened from the time she ever mm-hmm. said she wanted to leave.
Comes true, yes.
So, see, this is Liz. I wonder if, let's do a quick check and see if there's any questions on the line.
We have a question from the Open Justice Project. Your line is open.
Hi. Who is this?
This is Francine at the Hope and Justice Project in Aroostook County, Maine.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you. My question has to do with how the judge was able to be involved in the audit. That's always been a challenge, and we're in a very rural county. There are two judges and one family court magistrate that would deal with sort of everything. And there's always concern about their participating in anything that might compromise their judicial position. But their participation in this is really essential. So help me understand how they get to be involved in the audit.
The audit actually came about as a result of the judge and the magistrate's concern for the lack of information that was available to them to be able to understand the real-life experience of the victims and their children. It was questions that began when she was seeing numerous protection orders being dropped within a short period of time, when she was seeing many agreements coming before her that she had no reason to believe were not in the best interest of the children, but then when they come back later, clearly were not custody orders that should have been in place at that time. And so I think for the judge and for the magistrate, it was really about how do we better operate the court system, the judicial system, so that the court has access to necessary information to protect the best interests of the children and the safety of the parties involved. And so the judge and the magistrate were not a part of the safety audit team, but they were very involved and supported the process in terms of bringing critical decision makers and evaluators to the table and being open about what the experience was in Henry County. In my opinion, it does not in any way conflict with their neutral, unbiased view. It has to do with making the court more efficient, more effective, and safer for victims of domestic violence and protecting the due process rights of everybody who's coming through the system.
Because you're really talking about policies and procedures.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Francine.
Really,
is there another call, Carrie? Or question?
That was our only question in the queue
okay.
for now.
Okay. And it was a good one.
Lucy, if I may, just to follow up, the other thing that was really important about this audit is that Pam did a marvelous job of bringing together every conceivable perspective. So we not only heard from battered women, but we also heard from batterers and observed batterer groups, and we heard from defense lawyers as well as prosecutors and other family court lawyers. So we had a very broad perspective, and I think that everybody in the system was represented. So it was an even-handed process.
Very much so. Very much so.
And that was a really important important point, Gabby. And we did have an attorney who represented offenders in the criminal cases who was part of our safety audit team. And also who represented the batterers in a custody case also. And I think that did bring a really important balance, plus the focus group with the defense attorneys. And the reason why when I referenced she and the children, the cases that we audited were, in fact, women and children. It was very... very rare that we had a case involving a male victim that we audited. And I'm not saying that there's not male victims. There certainly are. But in terms of the audit that we did of our systems, they were by large women and children.
And you looked at 61 cases, I think.
Yeah. Yep. Oh. And it was random. It wasn't.
Wasn't planned. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, what you've described here has very powerful implications for how practitioners and systems function in these domestic violence cases. So I know that you're just kind of transitioning from the audit to the implementation phase, but can you take a couple minutes and talk about what changes you've made in Henry County or what kind of the key changes you plan to make in response to this particular lesson?
Yeah, in terms of general categories first, I think the things that we need to put in place is developing a shared language or glossary of terms among all practitioners in the system so that when we're talking about apples, we're talking about apples, because that was one of the things we saw is that people had different definitions of domestic violence, different definitions of shared parenting, a number of important issues that we all need to be on the same page about. We definitely need screening and assessment tools that are available throughout the system, and that there are local rules and state, potentially state statutes around screening from the time the case enters into the system throughout the entire process. We definitely saw that we need to build better information gathering protocols for recording information and for sharing information that protect victim confidentiality, but at the same time allow for their real-life story to be heard throughout the system so that everybody can take the necessary steps to protect the safety of the family and to ensure that the parenting plan that's put in place is the most effective and safe for all persons involved. We realize now how critical it is to build in those decision-making points, to be able to stop that train or that domino effect at frequent times throughout the process so that the system providers as well as the parties have an opportunity to be able to assess what's going on, understand what the next step options are, and make the decision of where to go with that information. Training is going to be absolutely critical to ensure that folks in the system who have a critical role in the outcome of custody cases understand the victim's experience and why they may or may not disclose and what options are available and how, you know, risk assessment and safety planning, in to ensure that we're not doing a cookie-cutter approach, but we are individually tailoring interventions and services for actual family needs. Some of the things that we've already done is with our Pro Se clinic, we're doing more intensive screening through our Pro Se clinic. We now have pro bono attorneys and legal aid who will take on those cases that that are coming through the Pro Se clinic or who come into the core process where it's they need an attorney to be able to protect the safety and well-being of the family. We're having advocates who are available to be involved with victims through the civil legal system and the economic justice system in addition to the criminal legal. And for many of them, it's crossing all of the systems. So you do have an advocate who is available to help them understand the whole process to do the risk assessment safety planning. That's definitely not in lieu of formal tools and formal protocols to have that done by all the system interveners at various points, but it's in addition to. We recognize the importance of information sharing across all the systems, so not just within the civil legal or just within the criminal justice or the economic justice, but the importance of bridging all of the information sharing in those systems, again, within the realm of victim confidentiality. And so the Blueprint for Safety was recently published, I believe, May of 2010 through Praxis International, and we're finding that to be an incredible tool for best practices in the criminal justice system. We're in the process of revising that under Ohio law for our criminal justice response, but we're trying to also expand that to incorporate a bridge over into the civil legal and into the economic justice. So we started that, but we have a ways to go. We just hired a self-sufficiency coordinator for the Family Justice Center to be able to work with families, because if we can help at the front end with some of the economic justice issues more effectively, then hopefully that's going to lead to more options, unlike the scenario that I gave earlier. We're also revising our curriculum for mediator training and screening process for mediation that is not just for Henry County, but it's statewide. And we've been in numerous conversations with our Supreme Court partners on looking at some of the changes we may make at a state level in order to better develop policies, protocols, screening at a statewide level to better protect victims and their children.
And can you give us a couple examples of what those statewide efforts would be?
One of the ones is the mediation training and the screening tools for mediation. We're also looking at, for example, for pro se litigants, there's been some recent changes in the rules of professional responsibility, so attorneys can give legal advice and now can do limited scope representation for victims, or not for victims, for all pro se litigants, and how that might carry over into working with domestic violence victims. We're looking at where early case management and screening may be important to develop a statewide case management, either Supreme Court rule or policy around screening earlier, whether it be for pro se litigants or in cases in general.
Wow. That's a list, Pam. That's a list. And Gabby, have you been down helping to work on these issues?
Well, we're just kind of moving into that stage of the process, but the Women's Justice Project plans to be very much involved to the extent that Henry County will have us.
Absolutely. And you know, I can't say enough for how critical it is to have Praxis International, the Battered Women's Justice Project, involved in this initiative. I mean, just the insights that we gain from having experts involved in the analysis and to see things that we can't or we didn't see internally, one, due to lack of expertise, and two, being insiders. Sometimes information is taken for granted that outsiders can see better, but it was just an amazing, eye-opening experience that I think will forever change the way we address domestic violence in our communities. And I think already we're impacting the services we're providing through all of the different doors that lead to custody as a result of the information we learned and the conversations we've had around that information, as well as the practices that we're starting to implement and the ones that we're working on long term. So I really strongly encourage people to consider contacting Praxis and the Battered Women's Justice Project for information. And that's how it started with us. I mean, we just, because of the Family Justice Center and the judges having those conversations, we called Praxis and said, help. You know, we're not sure what to do or how to approach these issues that we're seeing in the custody cases. And that's what prompted conversations about the safety audit and leading to the work that we're doing now. And it honestly, I really thought we had a great system, and we have great people and we have great pieces of our system. And what this process has done for us is opened our eyes to gaps that we probably would have never recognized.
Wow. And one of the questions I had, though, Pam, was the kinds of changes that you're talking about were the Child Support Enforcement Agency and Family and Child Services, were they also, you know, participating in this and exciting? They were kind of on more kind of the people being interviewed rather than so much on the team. But how did those agencies kind of on the outside of the actual legal system?
You know, it's really interesting because the Child Support Enforcement Agency, Job and Family Services, Children's Protective Services, which is part of Job and Family, the guardian ad litem, the local attorneys, all of the people who were involved in the interviews and on the team were, I think, were somewhat shocked by some of the findings, but were very concerned and very excited about the conversation around change. And they're all at the table to say, what can we do to change this to make it better? I think screening was huge, you know, just realizing that so many victims were going through all of these processes and never really had that opportunity to share information in a safe way. You know, not that people wouldn't be willing to listen.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that one of the systems that works fabulous for healthy relationships that is very detrimental to some domestic violence victims is the opportunity when somebody goes through Child Support Enforcement Agency to be able to address custody issues and get consent entries filed or have access to free mediation services to work out an agreement without having to jump all the formal hoops of the civil legal system. And what I mean is, you know, having attorneys involved and filing complaints, it gets initiated through Child Support Enforcement Agency. For many people in very safe situations, that's very helpful. It's less intimidating, and they're able to develop parenting plans that were by agreement, and so they continue to work together down the road. But for some victims of domestic violence, that process can lead to decisions that are extremely dangerous and detrimental to the victim and the children. And so I think that was a huge eye-opener for everybody in the system, is that there wasn't a safety gauge, that opportunity to stop and say, is this good for this person going through? And so I know we're going to be seeing that process being looked at. And you know, also looking at where we do have formal screening tools in place, such as through mediation, how can we be more effective in being able to see the red flags that are coming through? Because there are a lot of victims who either don't feel safe to disclose or who at that particular moment may not feel that there is a problem with mediation. But then because of the nature of domestic violence, there's an issue shortly down the road. And so, you know, how can we more effectively screen to gain a better understanding of what the domestic violence experiences of those families, so that we can determine whether the victim determines whether or not the ADR process, the mediation process, is appropriate or not appropriate. And
which is where you're going to the state for the mediation training.
Yeah, yep.
Great. Thank you.
I wondered if I could ask a question of you, Pam. Well, actually, two questions. So I wondered, first of all, if you were surprised by your findings. You had a long list of activities and work now that you've completed your audit. And so I wondered if you were surprised by those findings, first of all, and what was the most surprising thing to you?
I was shocked by both of those things, the invisible bridges as well as that domino effect. I didn't see that coming. And it was a very, and I can say for myself, it was a very painful, difficult process to see how systems that people with a lot of experience really felt were best practices and helping families. In fact, for some families, not all families, but for some families, had very detrimental effects. That was very hard to see. But at the same time, it's making us so much better, having become aware of those processes that we didn't see before. So, I was surprised by the findings. I think the thing that I was not surprised by but excited about is how everybody rallied to want to make the changes and be stronger and be better. I think that was really exciting. But I think that, and it's something that we constantly have to step back from, and that is, with limited resources and limited staff, how easy it is to get caught up into our little piece of the puzzle involved in a victim's experience, and that you have all these different people with different pieces of the puzzle, and nobody is really getting the whole picture. And constantly have to step back from that and say, how do we make sure that that there's a way for everybody who's in the decision-making process having an accurate picture of the real-life experience of that victim? And I think that's going to be a challenge. One, because, of course, confidentiality and victims not feeling safe to disclose or not feeling comfortable with how the information is going to be shared, but also ensuring that people in the system use it appropriately, understand what that means, whether it be custody evaluators or guardian ad litem. So, I mean, critical people who are going to be using that information to make recommendations to the court. And that's going to require it's going to require ongoing, you know, training, protocols, screening, report formats. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But it's still, there's always clearly that risk that people aren't going to understand it. So, and I think one of the things that I think it's so critical that people understand is A lot of the conclusions that we draw regarding, you know, victims being uncooperative or not protecting their kids, or, you know, why are they going back to the offenders and not understanding the economic justice issues, how we need to become aware of the assumptions we're making and step back from them and challenge our own assumptions to try to understand that from the victim perspective. Because I think once we become aware of those assumptions that we're making, that we can step back and look at them differently and ask better questions.
Thank you. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, and Gabby, I just wanted to touch bases with you because you work nationally, and I assume that other communities around the country are going to be interested in the audit findings. So from your experience on the audit team, and you've read the report now, is there one recommendation that you could give us that you think might make the most difference in providing safety for mothers and children involved in this custody process?
Well, I think, in my mind, the real challenge is going to be to better centralize safety for everyone, for children, certainly, but also for battered and battering parents as well. For children, that means gaining a complete and accurate account of the nature and context of the violence that's going on in the home, understanding its source and its impact on the children and also on the parenting capacities of the adults in those children's lives, and figuring out how to fashion parenting plans that are both child safety focused and child informed to the extent that that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For battered parents, centralizing safety means that we have to allow for the complex ways in which battered parents manage risk and safety, both for themselves and for their children. And understanding that this calculus for safety is different for every battered parent. Access to skilled advocacy and information is critical for battered parents so that they can be sure that their complex decision-making processes are as informed as possible and also as free from coercion, whatever its source, whether it's from the batterer or the system, as possible. And for battering parents, centralizing safety means that we should try to articulate benchmarks and support constructive pathways toward healthy parenting. You know, when the system works by holding batterers accountable, then violence becomes a less effective tool for them. But for many battering parents, they lack the apparatus that they need to parent in safe and responsible ways. So one challenge is to figure out how to better equip battering parents for the job, to build in and enforce access restrictions until they've demonstrated a capacity to parent safely and responsibly, if that time ever comes at all. I think centralizing safety is, I keep saying challenging, there are so many challenges, but it's challenging in a system that tends to universalize family experiences by treating all domestic violence the same.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing that we've learned from the audit, it's that we have to develop a more nuanced approach to these cases. Over time, across systems, and beyond the immediate threat of purely physical violence that so often distracts us from a full consideration of much deeper risks of harm.
Mm-hmm. That's great, Gabby. That's a wonderful task for us to start engaging in. But when you talk about the battering parent, is that something that you would put in the parenting class? Is that something that the parenting classes should be doing only, or are there other kind of just places in the system that you think that could happen? We just have a minute left, but
there are probably other places in the system where that can happen. There are some folks in Duluth who are working on this issue, and you know, one of their observations is that parenting classes really are focused on building skills.
Oh.
And giving battering parents skills is not enough if they don't change their fundamental beliefs about what's appropriate in a parent-child relationship, where boundaries exist, how to empathize. We have to do a lot more work on changing batterer beliefs, values, and views of the universe.
Okay.
That can't happen in a parenting class.
Okay. So there's BIPs and,
Right.
Thank you to Ellen and Gabby and Pam, and The final report on the Ohio custody audit is in its final stages. So I believe that those folks who signed up and registered for this call will get a notification, and that will be up on the Praxis International website. They have a library on their website that also has the blueprint for safety tool that Pam referred to. So both of those will be up, and hopefully the beginning of 2011. So if you're interested in those details of the findings and the recommendations, take a look. So
I just wanted to thank everyone for joining us today and offer special thanks to the Office on Violence Against Women for making this call possible. And then, of course, to the three of you, Lucy, Pam, and Gabby. We wouldn't have been able to have this really interesting training and dialogue today without you. So thanks so much for all your time and efforts. Bye, everybody. Thank you. Talk with you again.